خب میخواستم اول به همه سلام بگم خیلی ممنون که همگی اومدین. ما امروز اینجا میوزیم آف مادرن آرت نیویورک هستیم و حدود یه ساعت با هم خواهیم بود و راجع به پرفورمینگ ترانسلیشن این دی آرت میوزیم صحبت خواهیم کرد. من امیر پارسا و دوتا از کسانی که دعوت کردم زهرا ساعد و راب بورس. تو میخوایی؟ Okay, now we're going to continue in English. Everybody relax. So first of all, thank you for everybody for coming. I want to just give you a quick little idea about the genesis of this topic. I've been actually a lecturer and an educator at MoMA for about 7 years now, 7 or 8 years. 8 years. It just keeps going up. And simultaneously, I'm a writer, and I'm actually involved very much in translation and translatory practices, let's say, translating from literature, translating poetry. And one of the things that I had noticed when I did a lot of lecturing and educating in the galleries here at MoMA was how much translation was going on, but that it was completely under the radar and very much not a conscious thing on the part of the museum goer, on the part of the educators, on the part of even, I would say, potentially the curators and everybody who's working in the museum, in how we're transforming and creating these translatory phenomena. So the point was to, when I was invited to potentially propose a topic for this Brown Bag Lunch series, I thought I'm in the thick of these things, why not bring it up? So the point here is to let you know, I don't know that this topic has been broached anywhere through some research. So our conversation is going to be just that, a conversation. If you have questions, comments, anything that you'd like to throw in, please do so. In the middle, we'll also potentially have a question and answer session at the end, but definitely in the middle. Also, it's very exploratory. When I say conversation, I really mean it. This is not something that has been completely figured out by anyone, really. So we're really in the process of doing that. So the other point was that I invited Zora and Robert, who are the founders and editors of Upset Press, because if I were to ask you, when you think of translation, where do you think it occurs? When you think translation, where do you see it happening?
In the brain.
In the brain? Oh, interesting. Okay, right. But where are you conscious of translation actually being manifest in the world?
On the page.
In publications, exactly. And I think that what happens very often is that we're not very conscious of the stuff that's going on in an art museum. So I invited Zora and Robert so that later on we can actually have conversations around the differences and similarities between these, what we call translations proper, which are really a different sort of translatory phenomena, and the translatory phenomena that are actually happening in the art museum. And I think it's important to put the art museum, because in the Museum of Natural History, they're not concerned about, let's say, word and image and text the way we potentially are. Another point, everything we're going to do today is incorporating artwork mostly on view right now at the museum, experiences that you can have at the museum right now. So in terms of the spirit of this exploratory notion, you can then go in the galleries and kind of think through some of the stuff that we're talking about. One quick exercise. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to think about this this phrase. And if you know any other language, try to translate it in your brain, in your mind, or on paper if you want. The phrase is cats in bag, bags in river. Whatever other languages you know, try to translate it. Cats in bag, bags in river. Cats in bag, bags in river. I'll give you 15 seconds. 30 seconds of silence is a lot, so. Cats in bag, bags in river. Okay, the other thing that I just want to say before we launch is, what in the world is translation? It's something that very often we think we really know. I'm going to assume that translation is where an existing text is there, is present, is manifest in the world, and we're going to try to transpose it or recreate it, translate it, do something with it in another realm. Now, mostly, I'm going to focus on interlingual translation, right? But the whole point is that within the art museum, there's other forms of translation going on, and that's what really is very fascinating. So again, the point is to zoom in on the translation phenomena, not the artworks themselves. So I've just picked out some artworks that are examples of these phenomena. So we'll discuss them, but not in that much length. So the other thing that I really want to do today is create the typology. What are some of the ways that the what are the types of translatory phenomena that are there? Then what are the networks? And I wanted to put this in smaller font because we're going to spend a lot of time on this, a lot less time on this one actually, very little. And then we'll try to think together about what that does for experiences in the museum. One of my theses, my points, is that the reason that we have very powerful emotional and impactful experiences in the art museum is because we are in fact surrounded and living through a range of translatory phenomena that we are not aware of, along with, of course, all the visual things that happen. So typology, first, the interlingual, and we'll talk about texts. And it's really divided into what one could call text art, right? Something along those lines. And then text and image, which is more here. And then I'll get into intermedial, which is between media, right? Something, for example, subtitles in a movie or a script that you have, and then you go into a film or video, or even in our educational realm, visual descriptions. There's a space here, not by chance. It's because I'm very uncomfortable with this term intercultural because you can use it left and right, as you probably know. But I didn't know what else to put. So this is a working term, okay? So first, the text. Very obviously, that's what we think of very often. And the first type of textual thing or object that is very apparent in art museums are text works, right? Where really the work itself is based on and really completely made up of text. Of course, if it's in an art museum, there is consideration of media, there is consideration of material, and there is a work that's being, an operation done on the text that turns it into what we could call art. And a lot of you are familiar with Jenny Holzer, or a lot of her work is what you could call text-based. Text is an artistic vehicle, or language, right? Language is the artistic vehicle. And a lot of them have public presence. They're ironic sayings, they're statements that you can actually have on T-shirts, posters, caps, etc. And they are very often operated upon in order to change the way that that text registers with the public. For example, here you have a bronze plaque in order to, what she says, have the look of a voice of authority of the establishment. And of course, that kind of plays with that. Now, a lot of our museum goers, not you probably, but a lot of them, I don't know, maybe somebody has here the exact number of foreign visitors that we have in the museum. I think tourists make up 60-some percent, but that includes American tourists, right? They would actually be going through a process of literal, meaning first-order translation. Linguistic text, they're going to either translate it or not. Now, they may not be aware of this phenomenon, but to them, what's happening is that they're sort of exploring this as an artwork with the media and material and obviously the forces at play, but they would immediately almost be invited to, or it's imposed upon them to translate this. So they do it or they don't do it. So very first order, text, etc. Obviously, something like this, which is actually on view right now, you have the perfect example of these transitory phenomena. There is a show called Ecstatic Alphabets, Heaps of Language, and you'll see plenty of examples of this type of thing going on. What is slightly different with this, obviously, is the way that it's presented and the way language is operated upon. And if you look at the material, right, it's using a method and a final product that is actually very often used for images, right? So the words are transferred or transplanted onto an arena where image happens, usually. But of course, it's language as we know it, And this is where I want to go in the next thing. There's the beginning of what we call puns, right? Why do I want to focus on puns? Because puns make you conscious of language as language, right? Now, if you were walking this and I did it automatically in one of the other languages or others that I knew, you kind of can't make that happen in some other languages. It just doesn't work. It's impossible. And not to mention that this is an expression in our American idiom that we all know. If you walk the walk, or if you talk the talk, then you can walk the walk, or you have to talk, you know, what is it? You can walk the walk if you talk the talk, etc., right? I don't actually think is the artist American? I don't even know. It could be Berlin, which is kind of funny. But anyway, same thing here, right? Completely language-based, but we're actually in the presence of a work that invites, the title being Raw War, this would actually happen and exist really only in this particular language, right? So again, what's the point? First order translation, and now if we go to a second order where you're becoming hyper-conscious of language and its effect on you and the way that you're seeing the world and constructing it. And what's really fascinating, again, I would say, in the art museum is that you are using material that are not usually used in the work that is happening on a printed page, where only the semantics, the stylistics matter. Look at that. Who came up with anything interesting in their own mind? Janelle?
Thought about what I translated
earlier. What was it?
Gatos en bolsa, bolsa en río.
What is that, Portuguese?
It's Portuñol.
Oh, Portuñol. Okay, Portuguese and Spanish, right. Yeah. All right, so the reason that I show you this is, again, we are in the realm of pure text on, or linguistic text, let's say, on a material that is used usually for something else, which completely, based on the expectation of the viewer, transforms their experience. Now, Bags and River, Cats in Bag, Bags in the River. Does anybody know why this is actually being used? So this is where, even for the English language master, right, you're walking through these galleries, which happened to myself, right now on view, and you know that there must be something, there's got to be a story related to it. Does anybody know it? What would you imagine it being? Because people don't, this isn't something you say. It's not just a word. It's an expression, a phrase. What would you associate it with? Yes.
The only thing I can think of is you let the cat out of the bag.
Okay, meaning.
Sorry?
So what would that. What
meaning
would,
like you use another name and spill the beans.
You spill the beans, you say that. Exactly, exactly. Well, actually, I can tell you the little story. It's actually by Christopher Wool, who's the artist. It comes out of a movie, right? And it's actually a dialogue from the 1957 movie Sweet Smell of Success, and it stood for a coded phrase within that movie where a dirty job has been completed, right? So it's a transformation. So if somebody said, Cats in Bag, Bags in River, I haven't seen the movie, it meant that a dirty job, like something that is probably criminal or legal, had been done, right? So again, we're in the first order translatory phenomenon. What's that?
It's about a gossip column.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what happens to them?
I don't remember the details.
Okay.
Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster. Burt Lancaster is supposed to be a Walter Winchell character.
Okay.
Tony Curtis is a public relations man, and he's doing some dirty work for Burt Lancaster, trying to, Martin Milner's in the movie, trying to, as a jazz musician, and Martin Milner has a relationship with Burt Lancaster's daughter, which is based on a real life incident.
Okay.
He's trying to smear Martin Milner's character as being a communist.
Ah, as a communist.
Yes,
got
that's
it.
That's the basic thing, but right. It's about sleaze.
Right. Okay. Which a lot of people will not know looking that particular work, right? But if you didn't know.
I've watched the movie several times and I don't remember that expression.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. All right. Okay. So now the other thing, the next thing that I want to, and this is in ecstatic alphabets also, is when the text, visual components, this is by Marinetti, of course, an Italian futurist who explored movement and a host of things through play on language, right? And this is actually in ecstatic alphabets right now, where the juxtaposition of different texts, the use of different languages within the text, the exploration of the visual actually makes you aware not anymore of language as language purely, but as something where translation itself is in effect, right? If you actually go upstairs and look at this work, it's much less about any particular language or you attempt at actually wanting to understand what's being written or said in one, but about the notion of the nature of language and the fact of its playfulness and its creating a different order of the world in a different language. All right, so these are all just text-based. Of course, the next one that happens, and that I actually wanted to bring up, is where you have puns and language with pictorial forms. Right? This is something we see in art museums a lot. So it's a whole other realm now. Even though it's very similar, here we only actually have language, right? We actually only have language, nothing else. Here we only have language and coded codes within that language. But here we have other elements of pictorial language. We have color, we have shapes, we have all sorts of things. And this is by Picabia, who was part of the Dada movement. And it's all puns, right? If you actually look at the stuff that is written here, it's puns relating the work to artworks. For example, you have the Atelier d'Artiste right here, which would be the artist's studio. It's actually Ratelier d'Artiste, which would mean the false teeth of the artist, right? Crocodile painting, peinture crocodile. So it's a barrage of puns transforming the language of fine art into one far less refined. And so it's actually using language and pictorial language to make, quote unquote, a statement on art and art forms itself, right? Now, if the viewer, and I've been with plenty of people in these galleries, where I then actually and literally translate some of these things, because without the translation, you may actually not be understanding the operations at play and the sort of thesis or the point that it's making about art in general. Okay, so we want to show this. This is a very classic film by Duchamp and Max Ernst, I think, actually, where you have language. Again, it's purely language, but on a film and in motion. Anemic cinema works great as a semantic unit, except that it's also an anagram on cinema, right? Anemic cinema. I'll let you explore this. And it's full of puns that go round and round, right? Again, moving picture, thus the film. And language with full of puns. Without subtitles, it's something to notice, right? So you have, and they go too fast to translate in effect. But this is where you absolutely want the translation. Why do I associate this with what we just saw? Because that was a painting with pictorial components, shapes, language, and material, obviously. And here, you only have text, but on the surface, let's say, of a film, right? Later, we'll talk about film, but it's film where you have dialogue and conversations and the subtitles, which is a completely different thing. So for whoever speaks French, you're getting some of these puns. And if not, you can see some of the play on words and sounds. Chaude n'aime pas le chou-fleur de serre chaude. Right? So all of these. And we'll see one more, and then we'll move on to... This is actually on view, isn't it? Yes. If I give you a penny, will you give me a pair of scissors? But it's si je te donne un sou, me donneras-tu un, right? So it's the sounds and the words taken apart actually create a completely different semantic meaning. Okay. So, yeah. Right. That's right. So it actually plays on the whole semantic unit, right? And obviously, if it's an anecdote, or in this case, a wives' tale, or whatever the actual meaning of the phrase, they take it apart and play on language to create some completely different meaning. Now, if you don't know these languages, right, you're completely missing out on that. But you're aware of the thing as language, And this happens all the time. People recognize that this is language. And so they're in a situation of inability to actually understand it, but they're very able to understand that translation is not happening. And that actually is very bothersome when you don't understand what's going on.
But they're only aware of this language if they're from a culture that uses Roman lettering or something. If someone had no idea of Chinese,
right,
or Chinese lettering, they wouldn't necessarily...
See, I know what you mean, but I think that anybody who's coming into this museum recognizes that probably is familiar with the Roman letters, and if they're not... They're familiar with, I mean, this is a great one. There's a Magritte painting upstairs that says Ciel in Roman letters, right? And we actually talked exactly about what you talked about, which is even if you don't know that language, almost 100% of people, independently of where they come and what alphabet they use and what and the concordance of that alphabet to the language, will recognize that script and those letterings as language. I think it really, they recognize it. And so the frustration of not knowing is at play. I mean, with the CL one, it's relatively...
So, see, we all use language. If you took someone like who's still in what we call the Stone Age out of the Amazon rainforest,
say,
and showed them language, I don't know what they would make of it.
That's true, but those aren't the guys coming into these museums.
You're just talking about the museum.
That's right. I'm talking about the museum experience, exactly. We should go back to the PowerPoint.
Yep.
Oh, we are. Okay, good. That was good. Okay, so... Two very interesting works because of the way they integrate language, right? And the way, actually, now I want to get into the curatorial components and beyond. So the first one is by Frida Kahlo. And what you actually have is, you know, a work, an image, obviously, with Spanish text in there that says, Mira que si te quiero fue por... El pelo, ahora que estás pelona, no te quiero, which is, I loved you because of your hair. Now that you are bald, I do not love you anymore, right? Now, this also is a sort of intertextual reference to religious, some Mexican religious paintings where you actually have religious text, right? Obviously, this is not a call to practice or anything like that, or verses from anywhere, but it's a direct relationship of her or somebody with her, potentially. We know biographically that it's her husband, Diego Rivera, etc., but that's not obvious if you look just at the work, right? This, what I wanted to say is that this actual phrase is translated in the label that's next to this painting at the museum. Right? Now here you have Poem Object by André Breton, who was the Pope of Surrealism. He was, you know, somebody who co-wrote the first manifesto of Surrealism, the second and the third, and really was the theorist that made it happen. He did not create a lot of artwork himself. He was a great writer and theorist. But here you have the actual objects, and it's called Poem Object. Now there is no translation of these words or of these phrases on the label next to the work. And every time I've gone into, people ask, what does it mean? Now, what's kind of interesting is that you could potentially read these in different directions. It does make more sense in one particular direction. So if you go this way, it says these vague fields or these unclear fields where I wander, defeated by the shadow and the moon, hung to the house of my heart. But you could actually go this way, and of course they're positioned differently on the work. So this is in terms of the typology that we're just talking about and the performing of these translatory phenomena. You're in the presence of text along with a linguistic text along with lots of pictorial elements, different types of objects that you are in the process of making out and constructing as you're going through the museum. This is a fascinating one. Now, everybody knows Jacob Lawrence. We have 30 of the 60 panels that he created constructing the migration of what we call now African Americans, blacks, from the South to the North after World War I. 30 of them are up there, and he actually wrote the narratives before, right? What's fascinating is that the narrative and the pictorial language obviously go together. You cannot take one out. It would be actually really violating the essence of the work. You can understand the work in different ways if you take them out, but they go together. These narratives are part of it. They're not within the work, which is interesting if we were to go into the stylistic analysis of these works. But what has always fascinated me when I see 60-some percent of tourists coming is whether they actually bother to want to translate these, or are they ignoring them or not really being very understanding of their necessary relationship to these works. Going back here, very much within the work, on the label, inviting the museum goer to attempt to understand the relationship. Here, the American, obviously, or the English language reader makes the connection. But these kind of become potentially a completely different work outside of this transitory phenomenon for the non-English speaking person, right? So within our little typology, we had the pure text, text and puns that actually make you understand that you're really in the presence of linguistic phenomena and wanting or attempting to transform them. Then you had the entire work as translation. Moving into the second big point is text and language, which is really one of the relationships that we think of when we think of translation and art potentially. And then there you have different phenomena again, with text inside, text outside. And I think what's really interesting here is that it is a true narrative that's constructed between text and language, but where in many ways the text is silenced potentially. And the cultural group from which you come is going to be reading or not reading, translating or not translating, silencing in many ways whatever is active in this story that we already have a lot of understanding of, right? So I think this is very, very key in our connecting with these artworks. That said, I wanted to just turn it over to Zora, who is going to talk really quickly about another work by an Afghan artist, right? Do you want to?
Sure. This is an art piece called The White House by Alida Abdul. She is an Afghan and American. She lives between Kabul and L.A. Now, what's interesting about this piece is that there's no sound, and it's about a 10-minute video art piece. It's at the museum, and back in, I think, 2007, there was an event where Lida showed her work and followed by other short video arts that she had created, but at the end, in the question and answer, decided not to answer and not to really overinterpret what she had created. Now, to go along with what we're talking about, translation and text and interpretation, there's no sound and there's no text at all in this piece. What we have is architecture that we're reading, right? So if you see here the columns, the bricks, the way this is set up, it reads very differently for an Afghan who's familiar with this architecture and what it represents versus an American entering the scene. So most of the people in the audience had responded back, oh, this is the spirit of the quote-unquote indomitable woman, the woman who goes back to the rubble area and cleanses and sort of purifies it from within. The Afghan woman's body is read in a particular way from, I think, a perspective that's been inundated with news and images of Afghan women. So many read this because of the village being bombed, that it was violence within Afghanistan from the Taliban or during the civil wars or whatever, if the knowledge went that far, and that this is the undefeated Afghan woman.
What really would be more like an earthquake?
No, it's actually a bombing, but it's a U.S. bombing. It's actually and it's a bombing of one of the buildings. When you have those kind of Greco columns in Afghan architecture, they were built for they were government buildings, and they were buildings built probably in the 70s under the king Zahir Shah, who was trying to modernize and democratize Afghanistan. So it's very interesting for me to see how I read this architecture and interpret it versus how other people have interpreted and even written about this particular piece. And it comes from her not translating, not really giving too much detail at that, and really drawing in a lot of the kind of ideas people have, which I think revealed a lot about the audience. So the last scene of this piece is that she ends up actually painting a young man as well. It's very beautiful. It's at the museum, so if you should, you should definitely look it up. But that's what I mean about what's untranslatable. And she does talk about trauma being untranslatable. right? Regardless of.
And one of the interesting things when we were just, you know, I was telling you this was really exploratory. One potential thought was, should this go in what we call the cultural, later on, the cultural part of the typology where, you know, the culture that you come in with, the expectations are really making you read this scene and understand it differently? Or should it be within the linguistic realm? And, I mean, I think that the point of putting it in linguistic is a total absence of language in a way, but following a narrative by Jacob Lawrence, right? So this is full narrative, one extreme, but with an understanding of historical events that completely informs your reading of the piece. And then here, again, understanding of historical events or misunderstanding of historical events in the complete absence of a narrative, right, and how we do that. So one of the things that I'll just ask, we'll just sit over there or we, you know, have a little conversation. Zora and Robert really created a press, and one of the things was to really think about the way that the museum, in terms of expectations, motivation, acquisition, et cetera, integrates translation, right, and thinks about it versus a press. Now, in order to do that, I just wanted to bring two things up. This is a piece by Zarina right now. It's on view on the second floor in the Contemporary Galleries. There's something very interesting about this piece in this way. It's in the prints and illustrated books collection at MoMA, and it is being shown in this way. I tried to get a bigger image, but there wasn't one. Under each of these images, there are words, right? And those words relate to the image. They're very related. So you can actually potentially completely read the image differently based on the word that you read, right? And whether you understand it or not. So I was going through it. I was actually understanding some of them, and it's because they're written in Urdu, the artist's native language. And I speak Persian, and some words you have in common and some others you don't, right? So very curiously, I looked at the label. And the label only says, Zarina lived in Bangkok, Delhi, Paris, Bonn, Tokyo, Los Angeles, Santa Cruz before settling in New York. Although she also works in sculpture and drawing, woodcuts have been of primary importance in her work over the last decades. Each of the sheets in Home is a Foreign Place bears an abstract image and a word printed in Urdu, the other smothered tongue. The terms she chose, such as threshold, border, country, and door, so there's four words that are given, right, four of them, paired with her minimal images, create a lexicon relating to the theme of home. But then when I went through, I actually noted down a lot of other words. There were words like home, fear, rain, travel, earth, sky, wall. And I really noticed that each of these words makes you read each of these pieces and the collection completely differently. So my question was, in terms of the museum's practice of translation and the performer who is actually the museum goer, but again, now we're switching the nature of the performer being the curators, etc., should there be an actual translation of each one of these words? How does the art museum treat language and letterpress where the complete meaning would be different? Whereas in the press, and here's a full, what do you call it when you're... full disclosure, I'm actually translating a book by a Lebanese writer, and we're not going to take liberties in a way of, right, of integrating some words and not some others. So I wanted to just go back, and by the way, here's, if we have time or interest, here's one problem with translating. This was done in January, this is now. We can potentially play on that. But why don't you guys come up here and we'll talk about the museum press. Does anybody have a question about the... I'll just sit here and kind of begin in terms of the audience expectation. Audience expectation from a press. Where did you, when you thought about the translation of Nadia 20, this is the Lebanese author that we did, what was the motivation? I mean, I don't know, either one of you can...
So 20, she was a Lebanese woman poet writing poetry in French, surrealist poetry in French during the late 60s, all through the 70s. You know, her writings coincided with some personal tragedies in her life and a civil war in her country. And so she has this really big body of work dating over 15 years. She was celebrated in her time. She won all sorts of awards and received all sorts of recognition. And out of her seven or eight books, only selections from the last two had been translated into English. Mm-hmm. So after I, you know, was exposed to her work through those selections, I became kind of obsessed with wanting to read more of her work and begin the process of seeking out permission and, you know, trying to find out, you know, who has the rights to the first six or seven mm-hmm. books? Why haven't they been translated? Are they untranslatable?
Now, why did you, and you decided ultimately on the first two books, which are not the strongest works, right? Whereas I know that in the museum, the collection that happens in a museum is to really collect the stronger works. No museum wants to really have the works that aren't as important in the collection. You want the strongest. So where did that come from? Why?
Well, again, I think as a press, even before we, you know, took on this project, we were sort of concentrating on first and second books by emerging mm-hmm. authors. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, not so much of showcasing work, but nurturing work, you mm-hmm. know, supporting and encouraging emerging artists. And so with 20, you know, it was, you know, the curiosity of her growth, her range, mm-hmm. you know.
But, you know, when you say that, I mean, I remember, like, the early part of MoMA, this museum in the 19, you know, it started in 1929, but in the 1930s, 40s, et cetera, was to nurture also right. New York City, you know, artists. The role and the function has completely shifted, right? Now it's a global artistic, play, really. And now, you know, people are going to, actually the museum is going to acquire the best works of people right. who are already probably elements in the art world rather than nurturing. Although that can also happen.
I think it's important, too, for someone to see the growth. I mean, you go to the right. museum, you want to see the best works.
Right.
But, you know, you want to see the growth, too, especially if you're an emerging artist, so that it shows you sort of a pathway, you know.
Right.
I think Halal Pork, too, we very much...
Now, how do you feel the difference between, like, a museum versus... Where do you think more of the difference lies?
In curatorial versus editorial?
Yeah.
Well, editorial work is, of course, where it's a lot more hands-on. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of say and sort of like shifting around some of the things with Halal Pork. It was, it was his first book, so we did edit a lot and add a lot of suggestions right. and maybe even commission some stories.
Right.
We're like, write this, and then he would go and write that.
Okay, right.
And it turned out to be great. It's become one of the most popular. But I think the difference is that there's a lot more sort of hand in or conversation mm-hmm, with mm-hmm. the writer.
And what about because we're really zooming in on the translation, right? And this is, like, to me, a very poignant example where the actual translations of these words would have potentially made a radical difference in the meaning, right? I'm not pinpointing for no reason, but I think in this particular piece, having the words there with the image and understanding it would make the reader read it completely differently, or the museum goer. Whereas in a press, for example, you're not going to provide some segments, not other segments. So what is there a real difference between the function of the way that you present and distribute a work, right? In the press, you have publication and distribution. In the museum, you have collection and really exhibition, right? Mm-hmm. So where do you think that the transitory, let's say, responsibility lies for the museum? Or would you, I mean, anybody?
Well, does the museum have a policy about this?
I don't think so. No. You know, I mean, not that I know of. Not that I know of. I think that it's really based on how important would it be to translate each of these words or not. And I think it's a curatorial call. And again, I don't want to, you know, sort of be critical. It's just an observation that any wanderer through the contemporary galleries right now is going to be seeing all this language work, you know, and you were telling me that there's a lot of language, you know, text work up. The English ones are fine, and I think if we were to extend the critique, here we have a woman from India where the words, and all the words are not translated. Mm-hmm. So that affects the museum goer's reading of it.
Well, you know, we've had books where we haven't translated everything. I mean, there are Tatar terms, and who speaks Tatar? No one speaks Tatar, but we have Tatar words, uh-huh. and how do you speak Tatar?
No, I don't.
we have Tatar terms that we didn't translate because right. we felt like it should stay, and the sound of it was more important for us than
right.
the definition. So I understand. I mean, I just,
right, right, sure, sure, sure,
I just
yeah.
wanted to point out a few things that sometimes in the literary world, too. Mm-hmm. And Comeback's Exoskeleton, which is another poetry book we did, it was a lot of Spanish and, was it Italian?
Italian, yeah.
Italian poems that weren't translated, that was part of the sound and
okay.
the experience of
right,
it. So
right,
poetry,
right.
I think, has space in it.
But I think when we were talking early, the expectation of translation is literary, right? There's literature, there's translation. And obviously there's a lot of complications and complexities in translation. But you do want to conserve the overall meaning. And I think that with the tons of language works that are in the art museum and the potential relationship that the museum goer has with it, it really comes into question. Like, what do you translate? How do you translate it? How do you distribute it? What is the expectation? Because there might be a lot of frustrated connection to works, not to mention the actual reading of it.
No, I think in our case, too, what I'm realizing now is that a lot of it was generated by the author. The author wanted.
Right.
They didn't want to have the translation. They didn't want to have the footnotes. And
right.
I imagine that's probably similar in the case of Zarina.
Right.
With the understanding that knowing, withholding
sure.
that is going to change
yeah.
the reading.
And I mean, there could be many, many different types of solutions to it. I mean, you could just reproduce in a small facsimile almost, that entire work, and put the words down. Yeah.
So I guess my question is, what's the difference between having type mm-hmm. and something describing an mm-hmm. image versus looking at a piece of art
right.
that is so abstract that mm-hmm. it has to come from within? Mm-hmm. So it's like, where's the balance of that? You know, it's like looking for the balance of that is the
right.
way I see it. It's
okay.
like I have a teenage daughter who mm-hmm. doesn't understand, you know, it's like the, I don't understand, so I don't like it. Kind
right,
of.
Right, right, right.
So, whereas she can translate the French and
right.
come and be able to understand the type.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, it's kind of a balance. It's like,
right.
where is it coming from within?
Right.
How far you would let, how far does somebody take, you know, accept not understanding something.
Right, right. Well, and then, but what's the policy of the museum? What's the role of the presenters of works, right? And I think that's why I think it's really gone very unseen and untouched. I mean, and that's kind of why I just wanted to bring it to the surface. It's a problematic that can be explored and different solutions can be found, maybe based on different works, maybe based on different, but there certainly isn't consistency and there certainly isn't an absolute policy. So, how do we deal with this? I don't necessarily have an answer, you know. And I think that my answer would be if the words, so the interlinguistic translation makes a difference in reading the work, then this is potentially where we can find a solution of presenting it, especially if it's in the actual artwork, right? And I would make that akin to randomly selecting a passage from one poem and taking it out rather than making the decisions that you were talking about. It's almost like a violation of the work to not present it. But then you could also say, well, anything in linguistic we're not going to put in because, yeah.
I was going to say that by not translating every
right.
word in
right.
that picture,
right.
you're really limiting the audience experience, whether that's good or bad. I'm not
right.
going to
sure, sure.
It does.
Absolutely.
Because you're viewing it purely aesthetically.
That's right.
Now
exactly.
the letters are forms, like for instance, when I look at Chinese.
That's right.
That's
right. Absolutely.
I love it.
Right.
I don't have to understand.
That's right.
That. I just appreciate
exactly.
the composition
yes.
and how
yeah.
the negative space around the calligraphy. In fact, when I first started studying art history,
right.
I was very much a classicist and academic,
right.
and I really didn't like contemporary art
right.
very much, and Jenny Holzer drove me crazy.
Right.
Because yeah, I really preferred the Chinese way of just like uh-huh. looking at poetry or print or
right.
text and not understanding it. It's distracting me to have to read it.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to point something. It's very interesting what you're saying because these words are actually in the Arabic script, right? Urdu is actually written from right to left and in that. And they're sort of calligraphic. They're not calligraphy per se. So the viewer is going to have a very different understanding of this work, maybe a very orientalizing one, if I may, if we're familiar with the history of Orientalism, et cetera, which is a completely different reading, and it affects it. Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, bringing these things up, I'll definitely, I think, skip this. But I want to go into this new realm. Yeah?
In a way, Bruce Naumann's piece,
sure.
The World War,
yeah.
is poetic. How
absolutely.
Did you
translating poetry, there's so much of that.
Of course,
right.
Absolutely.
It's obviously, the job of the translator is to
absolutely. That's a whole new discussion. Yeah. Metaphors, puns, things like this. Yeah. What do you do?
You
can create equivalent experiences, right? So if you have a pun, then that's why the first exercise I asked you, you're creating a pun. It's very unlikely that you'll be able to find all the, because you have the phonological components, you have the semantic components, you have the visual. In terms of war, you actually have the visual, the letters going, right? And of course, you have the semantic and the connotations. Very seldom will you be able to do all of that across languages, depending on how close they are to each other, et cetera. So you have to make selections. You have to, right? And in poems, it's absolutely, I think it's fair to say, it's impossible in some cases. Then you create equivalent experiences, even though equivalency is debatable. It's tricky. It's very tricky. Yeah. And that is the essence of poetry, in a way. Somebody, yeah.
I was just going to say, I think also what it points to is the sort of harsh reality that not everyone can understand every single thing.
Right.
And so
right.
If your native language is not Spanish,
right.
You might, it would be lovely to think, oh, we could all understand exactly what the artist is intending to do,
right.
If there is an intent, but I think the fact of the matter is sometimes if it's not your native language,
you don't, exactly.
You don't get it.
But see, this is, but my point, you're absolutely right. The point is, and I'll get to it later, is that we in the art museum are in a network of all this stuff going on, right? And as soon as, that was partly my experience, as soon as you open up the consciousness of this network at play, then you realize all that you're understanding linguistically, not understanding, all of this adaptation and translation that's going on, rather than what I think is people's expectation of experience as a museum, which is the appreciation or the scholarly examination of one artwork. There's all this other stuff going on which we may be pushing aside or pushing away. And purely, I mean, here I'm focusing, zooming in on just translation, but there's other components.
Well, you know, excuse me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in addition to translating words that appear
right.
in visual art,
sure.
even just the placards, which I believe are pretty much all in English.
That's right.
Getting a multilingual
absolutely.
Audience,
absolutely.
Why,
yeah.
You know, why don't they have like five or
that's
six
right. That's
different,
right.
Like, you know, English, French.
Well, you know, in some museums
Indian,
they do. In some museums, actually. That's right. The acoustic guide, I'm going to get to. Acoustic guide has it in multiple languages.
Yeah.
Some museums in the world actually have a sheet that you can take around, and it's English, French, German, etc. And that's exactly what's happening, right? So those are elements or components of your experience that you're either missing or not based on the policy or the approach of the museum. Yeah.
Yeah, but there were some Renoir works a few months ago over at the Frick, and my sister-in-law had seen them in Paris,
right.
And she said she enjoyed them so much more in
right.
New York because she could read
right.
the...
Right, sure.
The,
and by the way, in museum experiences, a majority
yeah.
of people actually look at only the label, if you've ever noticed. They only read the label and move on. The average amount of time spent on looking at a work, what is it, 2 seconds, something like that? Less than 2 seconds, the average. So the person looking at it 5 seconds is saving all the ones looking at it for half a second, right? So the label is there. I'm going to get into this just for in terms of time. Films and subtitles, scripts, and there's actually a very interesting work up on the second floor, which will deal with this. And, you know, I was very involved in I'm still in the education department. And there's two levels, I would say, of interpretation going on, interpretation/translation. One is pure translation, and I'll talk to you about the visual descriptions that we have for people who are blind or partially sighted. They're not meant to be an interpretation. They're meant to be a translation of an actual visual work into an alphabetical linguistic communication mode so that the person can create an image of that work, right? So, first one. Film subtitles. This is a work that's on the second floor, and it is actually a multi-channel video, right? 9 scripts from a nation at war, 10, I believe. And what happens is that actors are playing the parts based on scripts of their own word or other people's words around roles that people enact relative to situations of war. And this is what, obviously after 9/11, using both documentary and constructed footage, each video enacts a specific position, like the witness, the judge, etc. If you haven't seen it, you should go. Why do I integrate it into our conversation about this? Because first you have an actual script, right? And there's the translation of that script onto a filmic medium, film or video, moving images, right? And they're doing it only in English in this particular case, even though the words might have come from different languages. And there are no translations or subtitles going under. So you have multiple layers. You have the interlingual transfer, and you have the transfer from a script onto the moving image, right? This is, you know, and I know that sometimes I might be saying, well, what's the connection? That is a translatory phenomenon, right? You have a script, and you're moving onto the film. So any film, in effect, that came from a script is already involved in that. And this is actually somebody writing on the board within this this work. But I'm going to now go to a much more conventional and maybe funner version of this, which is a film happening all the time in your museum experiences, which we take for granted. Script to film, number one, but more interestingly, perhaps, the subtitles. Can we turn this off, maybe? It's for the lights. So this happens all the time. And if you're like me, you probably are always reading, even if you understand what's happening, right? I don't know if it's ever happened to you. And you try to see the accuracy. Who has that happened to? Right? Right. Should we go through with a couple of minutes of this or no? Yes, raise your hands. All right. We'll skip the rest. So dreamlike sequence. And so the point is here that the subtitle creates a completely different experience. Whether you speak it or not, if you don't speak the language, you need the subtitle. We've all enjoyed plenty of foreign films. But if you do actually know the movie, then if you know the language, you're not free of the subtitles. Right, you cannot actually block them out, and you're in perpetual comparative mode, which makes you not enjoy it. And this is an experience that happens all the time. I don't know if you... All right, now I wanted to just make you listen to one visual description. Again, this is a very subtle point, right? And this is different from... We're going to play it in 1 second. This is different from this particular image, which I'll talk about, where you have an educator working with an audience translating, but only in a metaphorical sense, because they're interpreting the work. They're describing and interpreting it. That is different from this, where there should not be interpretation, right? Do you want to play it? But of course, the lines get blurred. Does it get louder? Where's the image? Actually, if you don't see it, make the image in your mind. That's what... No.
Few inches below the top. Behind him, the landscape stretches out, with gray blue sky filling the top half of the canvas and the ground filling the lower half. The young man has short, dark brown hair cut in a fringe across his forehead. His body is slender and boyish. His bare arms and torso are unmuscled, though the muscles of his legs are more developed. stands, hands on hips, looking down at the ground as if in thought. His left foot is forward. That's the foot to the right as we face the painting. It's placed firmly on the ground, taking his weight. His right leg, to our left, is behind, heel off the ground, resting lightly on the ball of the foot.
Okay, so I want you, I mean, what's really, to me, fascinating about this is that it's not meant to integrate any interpretation, right? It's meant for the person who is unable to see the work to make an image of it. So it's a translation, literally, from into an oral mode of a pictorial image, right? Of a visual image into auditory mode so that people can actually do it. Of course, it's inevitable that interpretation goes in. For example, when the describer was saying he has his head down as if in thought, if you were to actually really think about that, that's a sort of an interpretation, but it's an interpretation meant to allow the person to be able to imagine the position of the head, right? So this is one of those intermediary from one medium to another that we very seldom think about. Okay, interculture, going through it fast. What you talked about, the labels, right? The labels are meant to not provide too much interpretation. They're meant to provide additional information, relevant information, so they're really a translation of the possible experience. So, for example, with Zarina, I read it for you, self-portrait with cropped hair of Frida Kahlo. As you see, they do have the entire linguistic component translated. And there are components that one could say are interpretations. And that's why I put it in a third sort of phase of our translatory phenomena in the art museum, where there is interpretation going on, right? We're really blurring their lines. Now we're falling into a realm where this cultural construction of experience for the viewer is a sort of interpretation. And that's what happens in educational programs. In educational programs, you have an educator, a guide, a lecturer, who is discussing a work, mixing visual description and components of the actual work, all the formal components that you translate into an auditory mode with interpretation. In this particular case, you have another layer added because you have a lecturer, people who are talking about this work, translating it in effect and interpreting it with an actual interpreter into sign language. Right? So this is a translation of English, because I know her, it's in English, into sign language. So it's and it's actually called interpreting MoMA. Right? So it's a pun, actually, because it's interpreting the works of MoMA, but it's also interpreting this language into another language. Right? So the double construction. Now, we talked about this, but I wanted to just show you the slide again for a different reason, and that reason is the curatorial construction of experience and the translation, quote-unquote, metaphorical now, of our experiences. So, for example, when you have these descriptions of an entire group show, you have the aims, the function, etc., but it provides a reading, it sets up a reading for the viewer, for the museum goer, that's very similar to what I consider to be an anthology, right? And we have Zora here who created an anthology of Afghan-American literature, who I must say just won an award, right? This book just won an award, and the award ceremony is tonight, of all nights, okay? But why do I bring this? Because I haven't heard too many people talk about this, but I think that the construction of an anthology where you have multiple authors in one volume is very similar to the construction of a group show in a museum setting, right? So you have the anthologist and the curator constructing experiences, really translating culturally, and it is a different way of using the word translation, I'm aware of it, but it's a very poignant and important way that we're constructing a reality. So, Zora, what I want to just ask you in many ways is maybe coming back to that, and we don't have to sit there, but just talking in general, what was your experience in creating the anthology? We have a copy here. And I wanted to talk about catalog and collection. The museum collects And in that collection takes into account accessibility, scale of works, the space, the construction, and all the choices that go in there. What was your experience of the creation of an anthology? And then we'll connect that to what it means in terms of translating an experience in a curatorial sense.
Well, for us, the anthology was just to fill in, it was to get a lot of emerging voices from the African American community. It's very new as far as a literary scene. So a lot of the work had to be either edited heavily or they had to be commissioned. So it was a lot of outreach to artists and writers and people in actually visual media. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are video artists now. To write their Afghan-American experience to fill particular themes that we were looking at. So in many ways, like I said before, with the editing role, you do have a heavier hand in the selection and in getting the pieces that you want. So if there wasn't a piece on, say, an Afghan in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s, we found someone who had a family member and we asked them to write a piece.
So in your case, you were actually really translating some works, real translation, like the first level interlingual, let's say. But you were, what was the translation, like the cultural translation that was in your mind? Why have an anthology of African American writers? What's the point? You know, what's the function? What's the mission of something like that?
Well, that's what a lot of the community people were saying. What's the point of getting us that?
Right.
But I think for us, it was important to be able to teach that cultural experience. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to answer it accurately, but for us it was important politically and historically to write about an America that is Afghan at some level,
right?
And how, like, New York streets or Florida streets or something was culturally turned into Little Afghanistan. So we were very interested in that. And then we were also interested in... I guess giving a kind of an Afghan history, but within the vein of the U.S., if that makes any sense, that was interactions, U.S.-Afghan interactions were close.
Okay, so I want to come back to it is now like the form of the anthology and its similarities to what a museum curator is trying to do in a space, right? And I think what happens is that, for example, in the retrospective, for example, of Cindy Sherman, you have one artist and you have a construction of an entire career, right? But when you have the contemporary galleries on the second floor right now, for example, you will have a collection of individual artists, what you're going to have in an anthology, very similar. You have a sort of potential function of the collecting of these particular groups of people, right? And you want similarities and differences, obviously, which is very much like in your case, right? In these particular cases, I know that very often you can also have commissioned works, you definitely have a selection process. If you have the best artist did photography, you're not just going to do the whole show out of photography. You're going to actually create a sort of diversity of forms, of materials, etc. And I think the way to think about this type of translation, and it's big now in translation theory, which is why I'm bringing it up, is that there is no translation without the cultural turn, in effect, right? As soon as you're presenting an artist or a writer from somewhere else, or you're translating the work of someone else, you are involved in a cultural gesture, a cultural intervention. And that's one of the things that I really, one of the reasons I just put this slide back up was first we looked at it from the pure linguistic, isolating this work within these galleries. But the truth is that this work is not isolated within these galleries. It's one of many works. And in these works, you have artists from many different parts of the globe. And to not recognize the translation process that's at work, Zarina is also within this exact same show, right, is something that should be problematized, right, and dealt with potentially in different ways. I don't have the answer to it because it's many, many layers of considerations. But in pure, like not pure, but where we expect translation to occur, which is in literature, this has been problematized. And I think that because it's something that people understand immediately having to do with literature, right? As soon as somebody's from somewhere else, you're bringing it together, there's the cultural components. And I think it's, again, not to be critical because it is present, but just to say we live in a global art world and we're putting together artworks from different people into one space that we're experiencing in a very monolithic kind of way is not necessarily enough when you consider the potential for critique, for unveiling of what is happening between behind each work and in the group of works together. Okay, so just moving on, all of this was the first part, the typology of works. Just to do a quick summary, we had the interlingual, which was just first text, then text with puns, then text that really shows you the nature of language, translation, etc. Then we had text and image. Within text and image, you had simple text and simple image. Then you had puns and formal components of pictorial language. Then you had narratives, or the absence of narratives. After that, the intermedial, right? From one that we completely don't expect, oral to from pictorial to oral, scripts of films, subtitles, all of these are happening. So what is our point in many ways in unveiling all these phenomena? If we call translation phenomena in the art museum TPAM, here are the networks that the museum goer is actually involved in, right? Synchronic meaning, if you're in front of just one work at any one point, not a diachronic experience. At any one point, if you only look at the work or only listen to the audio or only read the label, which is never the case because we're always either listening and reading and looking, then you're having one single experience of a translatory thing. Let's say if you're looking at the Duchamp work or if you're looking at the bags and, you know, cats in bags. But the truth is that all of this is happening together, right? So I think there's always, at any one point, you have multiple translatory phenomena at work. But the true experience at the museum is diachronic. You're always moving. There's ambulatory circulation going on. So what's happening is that we have these multiple experience of translatory phenomena happening during our museum visit, right? From looking at one work to reading another one, to going on a tour of the museum, to then watching a movie, not to mention our, you know, the tourist guides where people are actually reading about the museum, about dining options in a different language, etc. All of this stuff is happening, which is then, I call it a rhizomatic translatory phenomenon in the art museum, where you have all this stuff happening all around, including when you come in, where we say hello in the museum in multiple different languages, right? And of course, for the returning museum visitor, you have cumulative networks of these rhizomatic TPAMs at play. I'm sorry to be complicating, but that's kind of the point, right? The point is that even though it goes very, very undocumented and unspoken about, right, in many ways, these layers of underground and under the radar translatory phenomena are really at play for a lot of us. So what does that take? What does that do? What does that do to our experiences? If you take into account the cacophony of conversations happening around you when you're in the galleries, tours in different languages, the visitor guides that you consult, the retrospective of foreign artists. I didn't put foreign in quotation marks by chance. I put it in because the foreignness of the foreign is affected by the fact that you have labels in English and you don't have them in something else and you don't have the translations. Are they Americanized? Are they MoMAized? What's happening to the foreignness? And that you have public programs like this one where you actually explore it. When you take that into account, the singular visual and auditory feast that you have is accompanied by a cumulative network of transitory phenomena in which one performs, you, the museum goer, and is invited to become aware of translations of various types, the ones that we all went through. And so repeated visits generate different forms, and then we can do that. So the one other little tidbit that happened is that today, as I asked my invited guest, maybe it was not something I should have asked him to do, but we actually put down, and I was about to point here, within this brown bag lecture, the various translatory events that you actually participated in. So we could actually construct some, but the multilingual introductions, what is that?
That's my translation of Cats in a Bag in Greek.
Oh, Cats in a Bag in Greek, okay, which you all did on your own. This is translatory phenomena, text at artwork. Okay, this is some of the stuff that we were talking about. Barrage of puns, moving pictures. What's that? Amir translates language interpreted in artwork. Okay, that's something we were doing. And then you were talking about, you actually sort of translated one of the Duchamp things. Combining narrative and pictorial, Zora translating images through silence, right? Films and subtitles, scripts, translating via physical touch, right? The touch tours. What, you know, so my point was that even in the hour and a little bit more that we actually spent together, all these very subtle and potentially meaningless, right, stuff happened in different languages where we went through different modes of interpreting some of the works that we're seeing and putting them together and exploring what transitory phenomena meant. Anything to add to that list? Did I miss anything? Did we miss anything? Not that it's meant to be an exhaustive list, but what did you go through? You were talking about your... who was it? Your sister who enjoyed...
My sister-in-law.
Your sister-in-law.
Yes, I think you captured that about the...
Translation in the label versus
not in the label.
Transition in the label versus not in the label.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
Which is something you were talking about. And I think what this really...
And that was a more descriptive
than
the actual language.
Right. So, you know, I mean, again, this is a subject that has not been broached in any arena that I know. It definitely hasn't been broached in the museum. It may be because of that, you know, this was definitely not an art history lecture, as you could tell. We really didn't care so much about the artworks other than how they were making us involved in this. But I think that's why it's not completely played out, right? These issues might or might not come to the surface, depending on who follows through at the museum or outside from the museum. But they're not without merit, because what I can tell you is that a lot of artists and a lot of thinkers who are critiquing museum practice from outside are very aware, actually, of these phenomena at play, right? And they're wondering how, from the cultural to the linguistic to the medial, intermedial, you can actually create a better understanding of all the forces at play because the museum goers is involved in them, right? Even if it's absent, even if it's unconscious, even if it's unaware. So it's something to think about, something to sort of ponder as you go. I hope we created a decent typology. I think the connection with where we expect translation to occur was, you know, sort of enriching. Again, there's no final answers or final solutions. But I know that once I went through the galleries translating different texts and becoming aware of it, I never went through them again in the same way. So I hope that now all of this work is up in the museum. If you go and explore it, it'll affect the way that you experience it. And we'll see what happens in the future with the exploration of translations in museums. Questions? I mean, we kind of did it during the thing, but any other comments, questions, anything? I also want to thank Kirsten and Jenna, who actually helped me with some of the PowerPoint. Anything else? No? Okay, we went a little bit over time, I think, but it's okay. We still had time. And see you next time.